Well, thanks to whoever requested that song. When I got, Terry looked over at me and said, was it you? Because she knows that's my favorite hymn in the entire hymnal. So I don't know who requested it, but kudos to you. And it has a special place. This is just an aside now. It has a special place as you look through the lyrics. You can see that Terry Miller, who is an excellent musician from the California, Southern California area, wrote that hymn in 1995, and it really captures everything that we believed in. We first sang it at the Feast of Tabernacles in 1995, and it, when you go through the lyrics, you realize that it was written in response to the preservation of the holy days and the keeping of the holy days by the people of God. So I know he can't hear me, but Terry Miller, we appreciate it. Okay. There's an organization called Freedom House. Freedom House is, and I had forgotten that there were these, but Freedom House is a government-funded nonprofit organization, which just means that here's a nonprofit group that gets money from the government. It's one of those things we haven't slashed the funding from yet. But actually, for the purpose of research for my sermon today, they actually provided some good information. What they do is conduct research, and they advocate for democracy around the world. I don't know how they accomplish that, quite honestly, but at least their reporting is very interesting because they report on such things as political freedoms available in all of the nations around the world, the right to free speech, free press, and they document that with all of the countries in the world. And they track all the governments in all the countries around the world, and they index all known countries for the freedoms that they allow their citizens. So at least one worthwhile thing that they provided was some information for my message today. But I paid for it, and so did you. According to their research, the freedoms in many countries around the world have been on the decline in the last decade or so. And according to Freedom House, for instance, fewer than 14% of the world's population have access to a free press. Fewer than 14%. That's a very small number of people that live in the world out of 7.5 billion people that actually have access to a free press. And sometimes, as we find in our country, that free press is not very worthwhile anyway. But apart from that, that's an amazing statistic I found. And I was looking for research on this particular topic of freedoms offered by countries around the globe. And I guess I was kind of shocked at how little there is around the world. Some of the worst offenders of human and civil rights are really no surprise. They would be some of the smaller countries around the world, but some of the most oppressive regimes, probably not a mystery to you as I read a list, a short list of a few of them, are the worst offenders of human rights and civil liberties and the freedoms of the individual. Some of these are Syria, Eritrea, which probably a lot of people have never even heard of, but is one of the north of the Sahara African countries in the western side of North Africa. North Korea, duh. No big mystery there, hardly any freedoms for the people there. Uzbekistan, South Sudan, another sub-Saharan country, the Central African Republic, and Saudi Arabia. Now, I don't agree with every single way in which they categorize and index these countries, but, you know, just for ballpark figures, they assign percentages from 100% to 0%. And some of these countries I've just named, guess where they rank? Around 3%. That's not very much individual citizenry freedom, right? But they're very oppressive. So even though they're smaller, it probably the ones that I read are no big surprise to any of you. But when you look at the map and how they've categorized them, and they have the entire world map, and they have blue is assigned to the most free of countries, green is where they have fair to middling freedom, and then yellow is where there's almost no personal liberty or freedom whatsoever in a world. And although there are great expanses of area in which, maybe I got those colors wrong, maybe green is free, but besides that, you can look it up. But anyway, a lot of the world, no, it was blue. Blue represented, yeah, that's what it was. Green represented, yes, I'm right now. Green, I got it. I'm here. Green for go. Green represented the countries with the most liberty, anywhere from like 70% to 100%. So that represented a pretty vast portion of the world, a lot, in landmass. But Canada is one of the greatest, you know, I think they're second in the world in terms of landmass. They don't have a lot of population, right, you know, 20 or 30 million or something like that. Another large space is Australia, you know, about the same size as the continental United States. Then a lot of South America has pretty good freedom. Some areas not so much of South America. But the most populous nation on the face of the earth, China, not much freedom. It's blue. It's all blue. Not much freedom at all. North Korea is yellow, the least freedom. So those yellow areas and the blue areas, which represent, and then the landmass, which is the greatest, used to be the USSR, Soviet Socialist Republic. Most of that is Russia, and then all of the surrounding little break-off areas are basically still as oppressive as ever. So the world's greatest landmass, Russia, not much personal freedom allowed in those areas at all. So when you get down to it, you find that, interestingly enough, the bulk of the 7.5 billion people live in countries that are subject to dictatorships, autocratic rule, very little personal freedom, and very little ability for those citizens to express themselves in the fashion that we take for granted a lot. Very interesting. You know, for those who live in the Western world, which includes us, we also find that the standard of living in most of those countries which have freedom of the press, freedom of speech, personal civil liberties, most of them have the highest standard of living around the world. Now, you'd think that if you had to live in an oppressive regime, but you also were wealthy, maybe you could put up with a few less civil liberties, right? I mean, if you were rich and you lived, I mean, if most of the population was really wealthy and you lived in an oppressive regime, but for the most part, it doesn't work that way. Now, maybe in Saudi Arabia, you got a very small population, a very rich country, but still, how rich can you be if you have to dress a certain way and you can't, you know, women can't drive a car. And well, maybe that's not such a bad idea. I don't know. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Just kidding. The country's lost half the audience. It's okay. They didn't like me anyway. The countries that are poor are also the countries that limit the freedoms of their citizens. And the countries with the largest landmass, Russia and China, with the largest population, Russia scores, glad Albina's not here to hear this. She might think I'm bagging on her nation. I don't know. She's listening. Okay, hi, Albina. Love mother Russia. But Russia, unfortunately, only scores 20 out of 100 in terms of personal freedom. And China is even worse. Scores 15 out of 100, so not very advanced. And as I mentioned, North Korea, one of the most oppressive of all cultures on the face of the earth, 3%. That's almost nothing. I mean, you can almost do nothing without the government knowing about it or being in trouble for doing something that you would express a view about. In fact, a very famous case of a young man from Ohio that was an exchange student recently, you heard about this, was imprisoned by the North Koreans. I don't know if it was a made-up charge or bogus charges or whatever, but they imprisoned him, basically beat him half to death and kept him in solitary confinement, released him finally when he's about to die, and he died a few days later when he returned to his parents in Ohio. He was basically brain dead when they put him on a plane back to the United States. Now, also not surprising to those of you in a Church of God audience, the countries that the Church of God historically has categorized and has identified as the descendants of the patriarch Jacob are the highest in terms of personal liberties and freedoms. The very highest. And not only that, but nations which have come into prominent contact with those nations also, although they are not the highest, they also score pretty high. And notable that just jumped out at the map at me was taking a look at India, which was not colonized by the British Empire, but the British Empire is responsible for setting up a lot of the institutions that are still functioning in India today, the civil service, railroads, and help modernize. Also, they got wealthy off of a lot of stuff in India too through the export trade, but they jump out at the map because their level of personal freedom is higher than virtually all their neighbors around them, whereas they score about 70% on the index. Pakistan, their neighbor, is in the low 30s. So it's a very interesting study from a sociological standpoint to take a look at this. So I guess India is even higher than what I said. It's 77 out of 100. I was going by memory, but in my notes it's 77. And Pakistan is – actually, I underestimated them. They're only 43, but I said the 30s. Anyway, the point of this is that out of 7.5 billion people on the planet today, many more of them live in poverty without freedom of choice, without civil liberties, without a source of accurate news. And you say, well, what about the internet? Hasn't that leveled the playing scale? Not really. In many of those countries that are very oppressive, they limit the content of the internet to which those folks can access. So in some ways, maybe it's made a small difference in some parts of the world where they have internet service or they have communication, but it's restricted in many of those cases by the host country. Now, it didn't take this introduction to help you to understand the state of the world that we live in today. Well, maybe it did, because for me it was kind of another eye-opener when I was doing the research, when I was going through this, to be able to see how blessed we are as a people to live in some of the areas that we live in and the stark contrast. I mean, you just take things for granted. The ability to hop on a plane or get in a car and drive or read a newspaper or have a choice about the news channel that you watch, where most of the world does not have that. But when we only look through the lens of our own societal influences, we're obviously limited. Now, I'm not saying we're bad people for that. I mean, we live in our country. We have to be concerned about what goes on in our country and all that sort of thing. But sometimes we do forget that the vast majority of human beings who live in our world today would consider our own problems trivial by comparison. And when their first objective every day is simply to survive to the next day, that's not priority number one for most of us. But that's the nature of the world that we live in. How did it get that way? I always ask that question, you know, going back. How did we get to the place that we are now? How did that happen? And we got to go back to Genesis to find out, right? So let's turn to the book of Genesis chapter 2 and verse 16. Genesis 2 and verse 16. God created Adam, gave him some pretty simple commands, gave him some pretty simple instruction. Genesis chapter 2, verse 16, "And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, 'Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die.'" Now, I think we're beyond the point of arguing, was this a literal tree? Was it real fruit? Or was this just imagery and symbolism denoting choice and command and giving instruction? It really doesn't matter, because in the end, whether it was actual or simply symbolic, we know that the instruction was literal in the sense that to disobey this instruction would be to take upon oneself the choice process of what is right and what is wrong, and deny revealed knowledge. Revealed knowledge, it came face to face, God to man, God to Adam. And it's obvious by the next chapter that Adam faithfully revealed this to his wife the next day, or the next few days after she was created, when God put him into a deep sleep, took a portion of his rib and made a woman. A miracle. Made Adam his wife. Making the right choice ostensibly would result in freedom for Adam. Making the wrong choice, would be controlling over him. Taking of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil meant determining for himself what was right, what was wrong, making his own standards up, kind of as he went along. If you like titles, and I know you like titles, and those of you that help me with the monthly church reports, here is the title: Choice versus Control. Choice versus Control. And so, since that time, man has sought to determine for himself what is the right thing to do. And as civilizations came into being, men sought dominion over other men. Men have been determined to limit the choice, limit the freedoms to others. And they have done a good job at it, believe me. Men have limited the freedom of choice of other men. So at least for some men, they've had plenty of options. They've had plenty of choices. But their choices have resulted in other people having no choice, very few choices, limited access to what is really happening in the world, limited access or no access at all to understand, to be creative, to express oneself, things that we can take for granted sometimes. Now, when did this all begin? Well, it began here. But as we read further into the pages of Genesis, we find that before the flood, the lifespan of man was mind-boggling. Now, I'll just take it for granted that since Methuselah is listed as the oldest one in this context, that he was probably the oldest man. He lived longer than anybody else. And he lived, what was it, 970, where is it here? What was that? Are you sure? All right. We'll go with Joe's answer and Danny's answer. 969 years, just a few years short of a millennium. That is mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. Now, not everybody lived close to 1,000 years. Some lived a little shorter than that, but this was all before the flood. And the population of the earth must have exploded as a result, which shows that on several occasions, before the flood and after the flood, the one command that man was able to obey was be fruitful and multiply. The one thing he was good at. But what kind of world was it before the flood? You can read the commentaries. You can knock yourself out. You're just not going to find much. You know, I've tried to dig into this time and time again and look through various Bible helps, teachings, and the like. There's just not a lot of information. So you've got to go on the information which presented in the Scripture. There's not much that others have to offer about that. But I asked the question, what kind of world was it? And we're given a clue in Genesis 6, the antediluvian world, the before the flood world. What kind of world was it? And when you read Genesis 6, you get into a couple of questions here as to who are these people? What was going on? Most of the explanations are wrong and are easily disproven. And the one that is most wrong, more so than any others, is probably the one that's more popularly taught. What am I talking about? You know, Ray. Genesis 6. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them. Since people were living a long time, they had a long time to go forth and multiply. So they probably had lots of kids, lots of marriages, and they began to multiply very quickly in over 1,000 years. The flood took place, over about 1,200 years of the before. It didn't happen until about 1,200 years. So you got a long time for people to go forth and multiply. We don't know how many people were living at the time of the flood. There were probably a lot, millions or billions. But it goes on to say that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Of all whom they chose. So who were these people? And again, as I said, there are a number of explanations given. One of them is that the descendants of Seth, which is thought to be, by the commentators, to be a godly line, married with women of the descendants of Cain, which were obviously an ungodly line. Kind of disregard that. There's no way to prove it at all. That's what some people have hypothesized. But that's not the weirdest one. This is the weirdest one that I was referring to. The The other weird explanation is that, and it's more far-fetched, was that angelic beings intermarried with women. Of course, that's totally incorrect because Christ said in Matthew 22:30 that angels don't marry. Unrighteous angels can't marry. Righteous angels can't marry. Angelic beings cannot reproduce. So that one is knocked into a cocked hat by Scripture. So that one doesn't fit. So what is the explanation? Well, the subject in verse 1 is the increase of the population of the earth. Men began to multiply and had daughters. And then sons of God can refer to angelic beings in the Bible, which we've already ruled that out, so that can't be. Sons of God can refer to the Son of God, of course, Jesus Christ. We rule that out because that didn't happen. It can also refer to men. So the sons of God were men. Wow, that's really logical, because they're the only ones that could marry women. Men marry women. So who are these sons of God? They were men. They were men who married women. How odd, because that's exactly what God told man to do. But there's a caveat attached to all of this. Verse 3, the Lord said, this is interjected into the thought, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. In the midst of all of this longevity, in the midst of all of these people living 600, 700, 800, 900 years, God is watching what is happening to his creation, and he decides that a limitation on age needs to be put in place, because somehow this is not working out. Now, that limitation happened gradually. Even after the flood, it happened gradually, because Noah lived for a long time after the flood, and he was 600 at the time of the flood. And then his sons lived for a long time, but gradually, little by little, right, see a reduction in the age of man as time went on. The lifespan of men began to be shortened. Now, move on to verse 4. The result of all of this marriage was that, and who knows why, it says that there were giants on the earth in those days, Nephilim. Apparently, either very tall or very powerful and strong, or both, individuals who are the result of marriage. Some people say intermarriage, interracial marriage, or whatever. I think that's stupid. But the result were that some of the people developed in these lines, in these genealogies, and they began to be very powerful. Maybe not just giants from the sense of being powerful in a physical way, but they're also called mighty. Now, when you mix mighty, powerful people at a time that was very close to the creation of man, where there's very little degeneration that has occurred, but what you also have to mix in is the lack of respect for God's instruction. So you had longevity, power, strength, probably incredible abilities of mankind, but mixed with all of the not so good things that appear in a world that is devoid of the law of God. They were men of reputation, but we will see that they were not righteous men at all. So therefore, I rule out the idea that the righteous line of Seth intermarried with the line of Cain. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but it didn't really matter, because man basically degenerated and degenerated and degenerated for a long time. And the result was a society that had very little personal civil freedoms. Not righteous men. The commentary from God in verse 3 about his spirit not striving with man forever shows that God was coming to a decision, if he hadn't already, about the fate of man. In verse 5 it says, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth." So get away from all of, okay, what does verse 1 mean? The sons of man, the daughters of man, blah, blah, blah. That's not the important issue. People get hung up on, you know, angels marrying with human beings, which is basically theologically dumb and dumber. And they miss out on what is happening in a world that is going in a depraved way. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And one of the most evil things that men can do, I submit to you, is the desire to rule over and have authority over other men and women. From what we see after the flood, and we'll get to that in a bit, the picture that is painted here is the world was lawless. Without law, what do you have? Anarchy. We've seen the results of anarchy in our streets, even in this country, where people take it upon themselves to decide this is right, that is right, this is wrong, we must oppose it. Those are the hate groups in our country today. And we have the best freedoms in the world. Some of the best. So it's not hard to imagine, judging by the world that we have today in our modern, enlightened way, that this world, devoid of any law of God at all, was filled with anarchy. And what do you have with anarchy? You have no respect for life. And so I would submit to you that one of the greatest problems the antediluvian world had was murder on a huge scale. Probably some of this is conjecture now, but you know, let's go down the path with me a little bit, and then we can talk about it in chat afterwards. I submit to you that the greatest problems that that world had were that a few powerful men were responsible for that anarchy and the killing and the mayhem that was taking place that displeased God so much to the point that he had to destroy it all, because otherwise they're going to just destroy themselves. As an example to show man, you're not going to act like that on the planet that I gave you. So there were no consequences for bad behavior, wrong behavior, illegal behavior. And the Lord was sorry, verse 6, that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, "I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I'm sorry that I have made them." But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now, I can't find much in many of the Bible commentaries about what societies may have been like prior to the flood, but I think that the few verses that we have preserved for us give us a picture of control by a few, anarchy as a result of no law, and a rampant murderous attitude that was prevalent in a world that caused God to exterminate man. And only one man out of the entire population of perhaps billions was able to find favor or grace in God's sight. Verse 11 says the entire earth was corrupt and filled with violence. Now, after the flood, in chapter 9, let's move up there. Chapter 9, God blesses Noah and again gives the very easy-to-obey command to populate the earth. One good thing. Did one good thing. Obeyed that command. In chapter 9 and verse 2, it says, "And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast on the earth, on every bird of the air, and in all that move on the earth, and all the fish of the sea, they are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I've given you all things, even as the green herbs." Yeah, all things that you would eat as green herbs, like cacti, you know. You have to understand this verse. God gave things for people to eat. Some good, some, you know, like Brussels sprouts, not so good. But prepared in the right way, I'm sure they can be good. But, you know, green, even as the green herbs and vegetables have been given, he gave animal flesh to eat, that which was designated. But, and we get into more of that in Leviticus 11. However, he also says, "But you shall not eat flesh with the life that is in it, in the blood." This is probably a reference to how mankind would enact, although it's not codified yet, how mankind would enact a sacrificial system as a result of the breakage of law, and how you would avoid being so gluttonous that you'd eat something with the flesh in it, or you eat an animal while it's alive, which is a hideous prospect for most people anyway. But knowing how man degenerated prior to the flood, this is probably some of the things that these ruthless, anarchist, law-breaking people prior to the flood were doing. But he goes on, he says, "Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man." Capital punishment instituted for the first time after the flood. Now, who is going to enforce that? Who is going to do that? Who would be the one who would enforce capital punishment? If you murdered somebody, who'd be coming after you to exact God's vengeance? Well, eventually we find in Romans, you don't need to turn there, eventually we find in the book of Romans that God gave that duty up to the civil authorities. Yeah, that's right. God gave the responsibility to execute his wrath in Romans 13 and verse 4 to human governments. He allowed it because he says they have a God-given authority to execute God's wrath on those who practice evil. Well, you can jot it down and read it. I'm paraphrasing it. The responsibility then would rest with the governing authorities. God allowed that from this time on. So we see in Genesis 9 the hint that human behaviors would be moderated by human governments. And then we find the example of the nation of Israel, which were given his laws, and they were to be the examples for all the rest of the nations to follow, and instead they failed too, right? I think it's Deuteronomy 4:6 or 6:4, just coming to mind now. But Israel was to be that example to the nations of God's law. So this is not, I'm not intending you to think that I'm saying that this is a carte blanche for every government can just do whatever it wants. I'm saying that the groundwork is laid in Genesis 9 with Noah and his family that eventually civil governments would be the ones responsible for executing the wrath of God on evildoers. God foreknew, foresaw, understood that man would naturally form what we call civilizations. And that power was granted, even as it was granted to have dominion over the beasts of the field. Verse 6 of chapter 9, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. He made man. God required the death penalty if somebody murdered somebody else, because that individual that was murdered was made in the image of God. And it was a desecration of God's creation to do that. And by inference, I take it that that is one of the main problems prior to the flood that caused God to bring a flood upon mankind. Now, let's go on a little bit further. Chapter 10 is a genealogical chapter. And chapter 10, we see the genealogy of the sons of Shem in verses 22 and 25. And some of this detail, I'm just going to trust that you can look up a little bit later. I'll try to faithfully transcribe it verbally to you. But I'm just going to ask you to do the research and look at it a little bit later when you have time later on the Sabbath day. So you see the sons of Shem and their descendants. You see Shem, Arphaxad, Selah, Eber. And then Eber, it shows two sons in verse 25. So from Shem, the son of Noah, you see all these individuals, and then you see two sons of Eber named Peleg and Joktan. Joktan, that almost sounds like a name from a Star Trek movie, but I digress. You know, like Khan. Khan. The Wrath of Khan. You know that one, right? Joktan, you could almost... Maybe that's Klingon or something. I don't know. Anyway. So, chapter 10 in verse 32... It says, these are the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations in their nations. And from these, the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. It shows God's hand even in the division of the nations. And then in Acts 17, you can look it up later. In Acts 17, you know, it shows that men are made from all one blood, and God determined the boundaries of the nations. That's very interesting. He determined the boundaries of these nations. So, one line of Shem, now we'll pick it up in the next chapter. In chapter 10 or chapter 11 and in verse 10, we find the genealogy of Shem once again. And so what does all of this lead us to? We see the genealogy of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And then it shows Arphaxad and Selah and Eber and Peleg. And then when you trace the genealogy further on in the chapter from Peleg, it results in Abraham. The other genealogy, Joktan, as we go back to verse 30 of chapter 10, it says, their dwelling place was from Mesha as you go towards Sephor, the mountain of the east. To sum it all up, one line, very interestingly, results in the father of the faithful, Abraham. The other line ends up in Babylon. In Babylon. The world's first great civilization, which we know from the previous chapter in verse 8, chapter 10, verse 8, Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth, kind of like those mighty guys back in chapter 6. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And then he went on to found other powerful nations and states, like Nineveh. Not a good person, according to tradition. But a mighty hunter, this Nimrod. So, chapter 11 shows the first great kingdom after the flood. Man had been told to spread out over the entire earth, but instead, a great number of them settled into this one area and resulted in the rulership of Nimrod, which is mentioned in that previous chapter, and then he goes on to found other areas. This mighty hunter was a despot. He was not a good guy. He's not a benevolent dictator. He was a mighty hunter. He was the first, after the flood, to begin to control men and their actions by offering them protection, apparently because he was such a great hunter. So man's history of limiting the choice of men and controlling them under the guise of protection or safety or government and taking away individual responsibility and freedom began shortly after the flood. It didn't go to the line of Peleg, though, who was the ancestor of one of the, you could say, greatest freedom fighters ever in history, Abraham, especially when he had to go save his nephew Lot from somebody that was a dictator and somebody that was going to limit the freedom of choice of Lot by imprisoning him. And you already know that story. So for most of man's history, this has been the case. Most people that have ever lived have had their lives controlled and their choice and their freedom restricted. And the line of Abraham suffered through a lot of that as well, coming down eventually into Egypt. But Abraham was a wealthy man. He also obeyed God. He had the freedom to choose. In fact, he was benevolent in allowing his nephew Lot to have the choice process of where he was going to go, and he took the rest, and he made the most of it. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all of these men, and then all the way to the descendants of Jacob, and then Joseph, and then the founding of the nation of Israel, and we know the story. But for most of mankind, it has been a history of taking away individual responsibility and choice and limiting their freedom and eliminating their own accountability for decisions that they would make. That has been the case for the bulk of mankind who has ever lived, and it's the case today for most people. If we accept the premise that we belong to the historical antecedents of Jacob, then we realize that the blessings and the birthright that were passed on to him and then to his grandsons, Joseph, were freedoms to be associated with a very few in the entire history of the human race. And then it blossomed in the 1800s, and the 1900s, the 20th and 21st centuries, to where we find the map of Freedom House, where they show that in all of those areas of the world where those folks went, very high scores for individual choice and freedom. But let's go back to ancient Israel, because just after the period of the judges, Israel clamored for a king. And in 1 Samuel 8, what do we find? Oh, wow. 1 Samuel 8. Oh, boy. The repeat of history, sadly. Now, retrospectively, we see it. But, you know, wow. How dumb was this? 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second Abiah, and they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Some men do that. Some men choose to take of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? And his sons did. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you are old, your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel. He knew nothing good was going to come of this eventually. And he told God, and he prayed, and God told him back, "Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me." And when does that ever happen? Always, always rejecting God. "According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will rule over them." And then what we find for the next 500 years is a repetition of this controlling mentality that men have to rule over other men and limit their personal freedoms, even in a country that was given the law of God that would establish freedom for everyone. So, as we know, by and large, this all ended in disaster because these nations were carried away into captivity because of their disobedience, because their kings had become experts at controlling people and limiting choice made by the individual. Now, get in our little time machine and zip forward to the 1800s, 1700s in England, the United States, and we're all aware of our shared histories, the blessings, the birthright, and so on. In short, these nations, for the first time in history, heralded the individual choice limited by law. The Magna Carta established personal freedoms in 1066. It took a long time for all of that personal choice and freedom and protection of the individual under the law to kind of finally foment and take place in jolly old England, but eventually it did, and then we kicked them aside in our rebellion to them. And the United States became the leader of the rights of the individual, limited by law. Limited by law, but governed by law may be a better way to put it, because under the law of God, the individual citizen in Israel had freedoms and liberty that far outpaced any other civilization that had come upon the scene, because that was the law that God gave to them. Under the law of God, the individual citizen in Israel had the freedom to choose. He had the ability to do as he pleased as long as he obeyed God. Leviticus chapter 25 is an entire chapter that is devoted to the liberty given to the individual in the nation. It is devoted to personal responsibility, personal accountability. And it is a beautiful chapter. Now, I don't have time to go through all of it today. But it is a book of law. It is a chapter of law that sets the ground rules over a 50-year period for how a nation would conduct itself in various areas. Inheritances, personal property, how the land is used, and so on and so forth. But you can read that, and you can glean a lot of great information from this particular chapter. And then people that, you know, sometimes fell on bad circumstances, lost their property, lost their inheritance, you know, that would come back to that family in the Jubilee year, the year of liberty. And so it was a beautiful system that was never enacted. At least as much, well, we see some example of that law being enacted, don't we, in the book of Ruth, which you can also take a look at. The part of that law was going to be enacted in that. But if something happened to somebody, or maybe they made a bad choice, then they could become an employee instead of a, you know, their own contractor or having their own business. They could go to work for somebody else. It calls it servitude, servants, whatever. It's just an employer-employee relationship. All of us have had to deal with that. Person would become an employee and could make a wage and could serve. But then to his family, if he didn't survive, that which he may have lost, he could regain, or his family could regain possession of it later on. Because God never guaranteed that there wouldn't be personal tragedies, there wouldn't be loss of life, there wouldn't be hardships, there wouldn't be droughts, you know, that you'd always be protected from those things. But there was a contingency built in. And God allowed that, I believe, to help mankind be merciful to one another. Just as we see the example, thankfully, of men and women being merciful to one another in this natural disaster in Houston. Now, for me, I wouldn't want to live in Houston. I always known that there's proclivity for flooding. But beside the point, you know, that's where people choose to live. A natural disaster falls to them. And it's nice to see that other people, that is the spirit of Leviticus 25 in action. Thankfully, it's there. You don't always see much of that happening in other places around the world. So this one chapter is a kind of a general blueprint for how a nation ought to operate. Personal choice, forgiveness for making wrong choices, no oppression of a neighbor. Not oppressing a neighbor who's fallen on hard times, not taking advantage of him or her. Fairness, equity, justice. In the midst of making of Great Britain and America, there also developed contrasting ideologies and systems of which you're well aware. Communism, socialism, fascism. At a time when the United States and Great Britain ascended to the greatest powers the world has ever seen, these contrasting ideologies, politically speaking, began to emerge. And all of these had ancient origins as well, going all the way back before the flood, because while they seem to promote fairness, and while they seem to seek and provide for all, what they really do is enslave other men, and the people at the top benefit. They enslave mankind even deeper to the idea that somebody needs to be in control of other men. And that, you know, we find out a modern historical example of how difficult it is to come out of a system like that when the wall in Berlin fell and the two Germanys became one. It's taken a generation for those folks that grew up under the oppression of communism to fully come out of that and really be able to grasp the freedoms that were given to them when they came into a democratic society of the GDR. These isms enslave mankind. They limit their freedom to choose. And even though our nation and many of the nations of the world seem to have, going back to the Freedom House map, I'm just envisioning all the green there, although they seem to have more of the personal liberties and the granting of personal freedoms, when you get down to it, all of man's governments control their citizenry to one degree or another. You're controlled. Tax system controls you. You take your taxes, just like Samuel told the elders of Israel. He is going to take his before you get yours. He's going to take your sons and your daughters, and he's going to enlist them in his service, and he's going to take your money before you have it. And that's what happens in our nation today. You get paid. Hey, wait a minute. I thought it was me. Whoa, the first time, you know, this is an enlightening thing. The first time somebody gets a real job and works full time. Whoa, wait a minute. I thought I was being paid $10 an hour. You know, after the government takes its take, it turns out to be about six. And then you have all those other taxes you got to pay when you go to the gas pump or the grocery store and everything else. We're enslaved. We're controlled. Now, you take a look at the tax structure of any free country and you're controlled. And we see prime examples of the controlling attitude of the ruling elite in our country, even as free as we are. You know, these congressmen and these senators, at least some of them, they get there and they find out, hey, wait a minute. We don't have to make ourselves accountable to the rules that we make everybody else accountable for. Oh, we have this law of the land. It's called health care. You know, oh, wait a minute. It doesn't apply to us. No problems, though. Hey, y'all, I'm fine. I'm good. I have my government-provided health care, which is the cream of the crop and takes care of me cradle to grave. And I'm your senator. I'm your congressman. Don't worry. I'm fine. Oh, well, your premiums are going to increase by 400%, but that's fine. You know, you're gonna like it. You're going to really like it as you go down to your government health care store, stand in a line, wait, take a number. Oh, it's 457. Then you hear the number called out, number three. Only kidding. But just like Samuel warned, a king is going to take your money before God gets his. Today, I'm not advocating rebellion against our government. We're very blessed. We enjoy much greater freedoms of every sort. But our leaders do seek to control us with the laws that they pass, and they do limit our choices. It's just that they don't limit it as much as they do in other societies. Well, something better is on the way. When we think of the return of Jesus Christ to this earth, one of the things that we can rejoice in is the restoration of personal freedoms and liberty for everybody, all mankind. That's one of the reasons the world needs the kingdom of God now. Under the protection of the law of God, that is going to happen. Turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 30. Jeremiah 30 and verse 10. After Jesus Christ's return, this will be the SOP. You know what that is, right? Standard operating procedure. Jeremiah 30 and verse 10. Therefore, do not fear, O my servant Jacob, says the Lord, nor be dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save you from afar and your seed from the land of their captivity. Jacob shall return, have rest, and be quiet, and no one shall make him afraid. It's not literally Jacob, obviously, you know that. That's the descendants of Jacob. For I am with you, says the Lord, to save you, though I will make a full end of all nations where I have scattered you, yet I will not make a complete end of you, but I will correct you in justice and will not let you go together altogether unpunished. Also, a few chapters up, Jeremiah 46 and verse 27. Jeremiah 46 and verse 27, do not fear, my servant Jacob, and do not be dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save you from afar, and your offspring from the land of their captivity. Jacob shall return, have rest, and be at ease. Leviticus 25, and its law will begin. No one shall make him afraid. Do not be afraid. Do not fear, my Jacob, O Jacob, my servant, says the Lord, for I am with you. And then finally, Ezekiel chapter 45 and verse 8. Ezekiel 45 and verse 8. The land shall be his possession in Israel. My princes shall no more oppress my people. That's what's happened for all of man's history. The people in control, in authority, have oppressed. Now, obviously, there are some servants of the people out there. Obviously, there are exceptions to every rule, but this says basically that people have been oppressed. But they shall give the rest of the land to the house of Israel according to their tribes. This history of the world, for most who have ever lived, is the restriction of liberty, justice, protection, free choice. Most people who've ever lived have been oppressed and controlled by men and false ideology. But the time is coming when there won't be the competition anymore between choice or control.